This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with James Goodale, a leading First Amendment lawyer currently at the law firm of Plimpton in New York. He's a former general counsel and vice chair of the New York Times. He's represented the Times in all four of its cases that have reached the U.S. Supreme Court. His book is Fighting for the Press, the Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles. Also, Dirk Hayhurst, a journeyman pitcher who made it to the major leagues and is now becoming a prolific writer with four books to his credit about his life and times in baseball. He will talk about the world of the national pastime at the highest level and his quest to get there and what happened when it all went away. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKN. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Happy Mardi Gras to you. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Inkstershow at WRKF.org. We're with James Jim Goodale, leading First Amendment lawyer in the United States and the force behind the New York Times decision to publish the Pentagon Papers in 1971. And he is here in our midst to talk about his book, Fighting for the Press, the Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles. And he will be at Louisiana State University as part of the Brose Symposium this Thursday. So 2 days away from James Goodale in the flesh in Baton Rouge. But right now we have him telephonically from New York City. And what a life he has led. Good morning, James.
Good morning. I'm glad to be on your show again.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and you're a man who went toe-to-toe with Richard Milhouse Nixon back in 1971, and I guess the case is celebrated now 43 years later in a way that is appropriate, but at that time, you had many people, perhaps most people, saying, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't print the Pentagon Papers. What happened?
Well, the reason people say that was because they thought that when the government put a classified stamp on a document, which meant release of it or distribution of it or publication of it, damaged national security, that one should respectfully follow the government's judgment in that regard. And that was their principal argument. It was proved wrong, and of course that argument has a lot of relevance today because of the NSA scandal.
Well, do you find parallels between Nixon and President Obama?
I think, unfortunately, there are some parallels. Nixon's is much worse than Obama on First Amendment matters, but in my book I say Obama is about the same as George Bush, too. In other words, Obama is not a great defender of the First Amendment vis-a-vis national security. He will choose national security first. I'll give you just a couple examples. Number one, he's prosecuted more leakers than any other president in the history of the United States. Bush prosecuted none. He is pursuing a New York Times reporter, James Risen, for leaking a story about Iran's atomic program in a book that Risen wrote. And it may be within the next 30 or 40 days we'll find out whether he will put Risen in jail. Mm-hmm. He has also not been a great defender of the press with respect to a shield law that's been sitting in Congress, which he put a national security exception into it and sort of spoiled it. So he's got an opportunity to be worse than Nixon if he goes forward with those items plus some others.
It is curious that both Nixon and Obama are lawyers, or Nixon was a lawyer, educated at great universities, Nixon at Duke and Obama at Harvard, and yet they've shown this disrespect for the First Amendment.
Well, I think that it's one thing to go on to a law school or indeed taught a law school, which is Obama's occupation, and then sitting in the White House. Obama has clearly gone through a change of heart once he became a president, and I think we're sympathetic to that, generally speaking. When the risks to national security were pointed out to him, he became convinced that the risks were really there and that he wasn't going to risk a lot by defending the First Amendment. So it's understandable, but, of course, it's discouraging for those of us who have lived in the First Amendment world for so long.
Well, we'll talk with James Goodale about the Edward Snowden affair and the WikiLeaks affair, but the book is about his experience with the New York Times, and on June 13th, 1971, the Times published the first of the Pentagon Papers, a series of top-secret Defense Department documents exposing U.S. government policies in Vietnam. Goodale, at that time, was a young man, the chief counsel for the New York Times, and leading the legal team, and you had pressure from within and from beyond. It was intense pressure. So getting this to the front page of the Times was not an easy endeavor.
The internal pressures were enormous because the outside lawyer for the New York Times, who had been president of the New York City Bar Association, and the former Attorney General of the United States, Herbert Brownell, told the New York Times it was a crime to even look at the documents. That created a lot of pressure for the owner of the New York Times, who was being asked to bet the ranch on this publication. When the government decided to sue the Times to censor it, to stop publication, and the publisher of the New York Times turned to the former Attorney General for defense in the courts, the former Attorney General said he wasn't going to do it. He had been in the Eisenhower administration and drafted the rules which governed classification, and he thought that that created a conflict. It was nonsense. But it meant that the pressures from within and the pressures from without and left the Times without a lawyer about 20 hours or more or less before it had to go into court in one of the great cases in American history.
297-5633. If you'd like to talk to James Goodale, joining us on Mardi Gras Day, and as mentioned, he'll be at the Bro Symposium at LSU Thursday at the Manship School, a man who is vice chairman and general counsel of the New York Times. He's taught at Yale, NYU, and Fordham Law Schools. And he is the lawyer when it comes to First Amendment issues, representing the Times in four different cases that went to the United States Supreme Court. Randy and Zachary. Randy, good morning.
Yes, I want to go back a little bit further to Franklin Roosevelt when he signed Executive Order 9066. Thanks.
All right. he went back to the 32nd American president. Do you know anything about Executive Order 9066?
Gee, no, but I know about Executive Order 1091. So I'll answer the question about 1091, which was the order that ordered executive employees not to leak, effectively, because they were told to classify documents. But that other order doesn't just spring to mind.
Well, I think Randy's just trying to prove that he's smart. We know that, but it'd be better next time to have a more defined question, Randy. Now, in your book, You write extensively about Nixon, and here's a quote from him. Subpoena all these bastards and bring the case. Destroy the Times. He was a worthy adversary, wasn't he?
Well, I think that he did want to destroy the Times because he'd grown up as a conservative Republican, and the New York Times represented to him the liberal establishment, one that had been soft on communism, and more to the point, had been very much anti-Nixon. Before he was elected in 1968, Nixon threatened a lawsuit against the Times for remarks made about Agnew by the New York Times editorial page. And it went from that, which was bad enough, to much worse. He had Agnew out as an attack dog, beating up on the New York Times and the press, and then the Pentagon Papers case came along, and he showed his true colors and said, let's get rid of this thing.
The book is Fighting for the Press from James Goodale, the inside story of the Pentagon Papers and other battles. Gay Talese says, exciting and easy to read. The comparison of Obama to Nixon is chilling. Bruce and Walden. Good morning, Bruce. You're on the air with James Goodale.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the conversation. I just read Dollarocracy by John Nichols, which talks about the money media complex and the disappearance largely of reporting and the journalism with integrity. I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, you know, that comment was made quite frequently when we had an establishment press and before we had the Internet. I think that the establishment press today is pretty damn good and even better than perhaps it was when it was sitting on top of the media mountain, so to speak. And secondly, I don't think we can exclude what has been said on the net. Now, a lot of the net material is not believable, but it's fearless. So I think you take the combination of how the establishment press is performing today, and then you throw in some of these really good websites, I would say, generally speaking, it's better than it was before.
Thank you, Bruce. 877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Jim Goodale. At the age of 29, he set up the legal department at the New York Times, became its first general attorney in 1963, and a year later, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that New York Times versus Sullivan, it ruled in favor of the Times 9-0, overturning a libel conviction and establishing the modern rules for libel for public figures, in which actual malice has to be shown. Tell us about the particulars of that case.
Well, let me say first that the reason I'm coming down to Baton Rouge on Thursday is because of the Bro Conference to which you referred earlier in this show, which is going to discuss this Sullivan case. It was a case in which the New York Times was sued for libel by the county commissioner of Montgomery, Alabama. And it was being sued for an ad which it had run, which libeled, this commissioner said, badly. And so that was the bare outlines of the case. But what the case was really about was that the Alabama commissioner and the others who ultimately joined him in that suit wanted to stop the Times from publishing information about the civil rights movement. And the way that was going to happen was there would be a libel suit, there would be a big damage award, and the New York Times would be in deep doo-doo. It was not a real libel suit when you pull it apart from a legal point of view. But since it was going through the then, I would say, prejudiced Alabama courts, it was made into a suit that caused the New York Times damage. But that was just a pretext, a way around the legal system, in a sense, to stop coverage, not only by the Times, by the way, but by all the northern media of Martin Luther King, his marches, the sit-ins, and all that sort of thing.
And Nixon had a connection to that case, didn't he?
Nixon had a connection to that case? You'll have to remind me.
I think he was a lawyer at one point for the other side.
Oh, was he? Well, so. You know, he may have been.
I think he was. That was in his time between losing the race for the presidency and the race to become governor of California and ultimately his election to president.
Well, you know, it was a strange thing. We talk about he may have been involved in the background of this case. It wouldn't surprise me. But now that you mention the lawyer involved in the case, it's sort of an interesting story. The lawyer who was the lead lawyer in that case had been and was at the time he brought the suit the lawyer for the Montgomery or Birmingham paper.
Hold that thought. We'll be back with James Goodale in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. James Goodale is our guest. He'll be at LSU this Thursday for the Bro Symposium. And the major topic will be the 50th anniversary of the New York Times case in which the Times prevailed against the U.S. government. Against Sullivan, 9-0, overturning a libel conviction and establishing the modern rules for libel for public figures. James Goodale just went over that case, and the Times went toe-to-toe with the government in the Pentagon Papers, which is the focus, primary focus of James's book, Fighting for the Press, the Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles. Patrick in Bro Bridge. Patrick, good morning. You're on the air with James Goodale.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Goodale, I've got a question, and I'm not questioning anything in your book, but who makes the decision in the government to prosecute the leakers? Surely it's not the president.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. The decision to prosecute the leakers in the first instance is made by government lawyers in the Justice Department. And there is a unit that specializes in that type of prosecutions. Since they are, inferior lawyers in terms of the pecking order, they can't go forward without approval by the attorney general.
And
the attorney general would make the final decision. Therefore, if your comment is it's not fair, I think this is what you're saying implicitly, not fair to pick on Obama because he doesn't make the decision. I think that's fair comment. But Obama is responsible for the decisions made by his Justice Department. And once he becomes aware that the department, as it presently it is doing now, has a practice of prosecuting leakers, the phone is, you know, only a second away, and in my view, he should tell the attorney general to lay off. I mean, it's not as though there's just been one isolated prosecution. I mean, we're looking at six or seven or something like that. And some of Obama's private comments have indicated that he's quite happy that these prosecutions go ahead.
And what are the severities of the leak? I mean, surely they make a decision on, okay, this leak is worse than this one. This one has compromised national security worse than this one. And I'm no fan of Obama, but it just seems, you're throwing a blanket statement over the president, both Bush and Obama.
Well, the blanket statement seems to me to be a fair statement. Because of the reasons you just said, in a sense, because the leaks have all colors, the ones that we're talking about here, and one would argue whether they're all serious on their face. For example, one leak involved a claim by an NSA employee, and this isn't Snowden, that the NSA was wasting taxpayers' money with respect to the type of cryptographic material it was purchasing from outside vendors. And the person who was distressed about this said this was not a good use of money because of an inferior product. He told that to the Baltimore Sun. The Sun published it, and then he, the leaker, was prosecuted for that leak. When he was brought before a judge, the judge said, come on, he's only trying to help the American taxpayer. I'm not going to send this guy to jail. I'll fine him or deal with him in a very minor fashion. So, in response to your question as to what kind of leaks Obama is dealing with, he's dealing with all sorts, and there's no, or his Justice Department is, and they're not making any decision as to which ones are important and which aren't.
Mm-hmm. 297-5633 is your number. What's your take of the Snowden case?
Of the Snowden case? I think my take is twofold. I think that Snowden did a great service to the American public. by having us engage in a debate as to what appropriate surveillance the NSA should engage in, whether it should be spying on Americans through the metadata they collect for their phones, as one example. And President Obama said he welcomed the debate. The other point of view is that I think Snowden made a terrible mistake by going to Russia. It just makes him look like a spy. I don't think he's sharing the information with the Russians, but it's hard to say that he isn't. And I think, accordingly, when someone decides to break the rules, one should face up to the punishment. And I think he should come back and face the music.
Well, in one of the later chapters of your book, Fighting for the Press, James Goodale writes, Obama is no better than Bush in many aspects of the war against the press. And in some respects, he is worse. He has used the criminal system to plug leaks to the press in an unprecedented fashion. He's watered down a proposed federal shield law. He's asked a New York Times reporter to disclose sources, but there may be more anti-press action to come from the Obama presidency. Obama is presently pursuing Julian Assange for publishing information leaked to him by Bradley Manning. If he succeeds in this effort, he will have succeeded where Richard Nixon failed. Now, if a Republican president were doing what President Obama is doing, my guess is that he or she would receive more criticism for this so-called war against the press.
I think that's a fair comment. Obama is getting a pass by all of us, I think, including the press, because I think many of us, but not necessarily the last caller, would like him to succeed. And for that reason, no one's rising up and battling him. With respect to the point that I make in that chapter, Julian Assange, we haven't talked about Julian Assange. He's sitting inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London for his part in the WikiLeaks leak. He will not dare to step out of that embassy because he'll lose diplomatic immunity. He'll be arrested, and it is his belief he will come back and face indictment by a grand jury which has been sitting there in Virginia for 4 years for leaking the or his participation in the WikiLeaks incident. The claim is that he conspired with the leaker, whose name is Private Manning, to cause the leak to appear on his website and also in the New York Times. Now, when someone is asked to defend a conspiracy, it's not as though that person violated the law in question, which Manning did. He doesn't have to violate the law. All he has to do is agree with Manning that Manning violated. Now, that does not require much proof. And Nixon, in fact, tried to do the same thing with the New York Times once the publication had taken place of the Pentagon Papers. He tried to indict the New York Times for conspiring with anti-war protesters to publish the New York Times. The grand jury sat for 18 months. Nixon gave up. Obama has not yet given up because that grand jury is still sitting there. Until the grand jury is disbanded, there's a distinct possibility that if Obama goes forward with this case, and compared to Nixon, who didn't, he will have succeeded where Nixon failed.
This is a story worthy of John Grisham, writes Dan Rather, except this one actually happened. In fact, it's still unfolding. That from Mr. Rather about fighting for the press. A few items before we let you go, James Goodale. Carl Bernstein was on this program not so long ago, and we talked about the Alger Hiss case, and Nixon's aversion to the press, the media, really stemmed largely from what happened with that. And you, like Mr. Bernstein, acknowledged that in the Hiss case, Nixon probably was right.
Well, the Alger Hiss case is a great case. In the book, I said it was 14 when the case came out. My mother had gone to Europe with Algie Hiss, and therefore it piqued my interest, and I switched over from collecting baseball cards to following every part of the Alger Hiss. His documents were typed, that's to say, the documents given to the person who complained about Hiss were typed on a Woodstock typewriter. The typewriter was found. It was the typewriter that Alger Hiss once owned, and that was the end of it, as far as I was concerned. And the Hiss case, it comes up in the Pentagon Papers case because Nixon keeps referring to it. He said, well, this is the way we got Alger Hiss, and so we'll just get the New York Times the same way. But there's one difference. There was no Woodstock typewriter in the Pentagon Papers case.
There was no smoking keyboard.
No smoking keyboard.
but that shaped Nixon's view of the press, and you have another chapter, Nixon's Revenge, and this is a much less publicized case, the Brandsburg case. What happened in this one?
Well, I think that most of your listeners have heard about reporters who want to protect their sources. Nixon brought a suit against a New York Times reporter, asking that reporter to give up its sources. And we joined forces with our reporter and took to the Supreme Court. We did not win, but we did not lose because there was a split decision. And the importance of protecting sources, to me, is evident. And the reason it is evident is that we want people to have the ability to speak anonymously about government particularly. And if, in fact, they have to cough up their sources, they won't do it. And therefore, we'd all be the worse off for it. That case, X years ago, has morphed into about 1,200, if you can believe it, versions thereof, as lawyers would say. And the battle over sources continues to this very moment. And indeed, Obama is chasing James Risen for his sources, and I'm scared to death that Obama, or as the earlier caller correctly put it, the Justice Department, will put Risen in jail, but he's not going to cough up.
Adam asks, how heroic a figure was Daniel Ellsberg?
Well, Daniel Ellsberg has turned out to be a folk hero. I think that's a fair characterization of what he's become. In my view, when we pick out the heroes in the Pentagon Papers case, and Ellsberg was the one who leaked the papers to the New York Times. Unsurprisingly, I would say the owner of the New York Times is a great hero in the case, because he bet the ranch on this case. If he lost, the paper would have been damaged badly. Therefore, when I compare him to Ellsberg, I say, gee, he's a much better, bigger hero than Ellsberg. But Ellsberg, as I say, has become a folk hero for leaking. I'm not a leaker myself, and so I can't get on his bandwagon as much as, not again, unsurprisingly, I am on the bandwagon of Arthur O. Sulzberger, the owner of the New York Times.
How were subscriptions affected in advertising when that event unfolded?
I don't think that you can make a case that the advertising and subscriptions went down. I don't know the answer to that question. I would suspect, to tell the truth, the subscriptions probably went up and the advertising remained constant. But you got to understand that the New York Times has, generally speaking, never been a thriving economic institution. And the amount of money that was being made at the time of the publication of the Pentagon Papers was slight indeed. And if, in fact, the paper had lost, let's say because paper had been duped into thinking the papers from Ellsberg were real when, in fact, they were fake, or if the New York Times was found to be a traitor, the reputation of the New York Times would have plummeted, and it would have been very difficult to make a comeback from that in an economic situation which not particularly thriving for the times at that moment.
Well, James, we thank you for joining us today. We look forward to your visit to Baton Rouge and actually be in tomorrow night, and he will be at the Manship School on Thursday for the Bro Symposium, and the discussion will be about affairs of the media and contested cases in the courts, and we will talk at that time, James will, about New York Times versus Sullivan, and of course we'll, I'm sure, get a recap again of the fabled Pentagon Papers case. Thank you, sir.
Hey, thank you for asking me.
My pleasure. Take care. 297-5633, your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. And we're joined by Dirk Hayhurst. He's the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The Bullpen Gospels and Out of My League. And he's back with another book about his sport, baseball, Bigger Than the Game, Restitching a Major League Life, the best writer in a baseball uniform, says the New York Times' Tyler Kepner. Good morning, Dirk Hayhurst.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Nice to talk with you, Dirk. You had quite a adventure in the national pastime. Went to Kent State University, the alma mater of Nick Saban, by the way. And you drafted in the eighth round in 2003. And the odds are always against an eighth rounder making it to the major leagues. You did it, but you had a circuitous voyage to get to the big show.
That's right. I took the long way around, and I think that's really the only path that a guy with my very average middling talent can take. You know, for most guys who are drafted in the later rounds, it's not just talent that gets you there. It's luck and opportunity, and really somebody at the top has to break down in order for you to get that shot. So I spent 6 years in the minors, 3 years sleeping in my grandmother's basement because I didn't make enough playing minor league baseball to afford to live any other way but below the poverty line. And finally, just when I thought it was time for me to hang up my cleats because I had wasted enough of my young life on a career that wasn't going to translate into anything else, I broke in. I finally made it up there. And it didn't go the way I thought it would. I got my butt soundly whipped, but I will always get to say I put up a 10 ERA in the big leagues.
You did with three different teams, and you got to the big leagues, what, you were 20, in your late 20s, right?
Correct. I was 26 when I broke in.
So at that time, teams often give up on players who've toiled in the minors, but you stayed the course. And as we saw in Bull Durham 26 years ago, there's a huge experience difference between playing in the big leagues and playing in the minors.
Oh, it's night and day. I mean, it's not even – I think the only way it's comparable is that the bases are the same distance, and that is about it, because – it goes from being this practice scenario in the minors where you are, you're basically just learning skill sets.
We'll be back with Dirk Hayhurst after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We're with Dirk Hayhurst, a man of letters and a broadcaster and former major league pitcher, graduate of Kent State University, and he has written his fourth book about his experience in baseball, Bigger Than the Game, Restitching a Major League Life. After nearly a decade in the minors, Dirk defied the odds, climbed onto the pitcher's mound for the Toronto Blue Jays, newly married with a big league paycheck and a brand new house. He was ready for a great season in the bigs. And what happens?
Well, just when life couldn't get any sweeter, it doesn't. I go into the weight room, and I really want to get in the best shape I could possibly get into because this was the opportunity of a lifetime. And I knew that I wasn't going to get this shot again. So there could be no half measures. And in the off season, I start hiring these big-time trainers and I go into the gym twice a day because I know that I have to compete against these studs that already have established themselves, and the organization's paying them big money either through their signing bonus or through their current contracts in the majors. So this is my competition now. It's just Now, it's not just minor league guys anymore. So I go above and beyond in the weight room, and I end up blowing my shoulder out on the bench press, of all things. And in the off season, the team doesn't have to keep you if they don't want to. If you get hurt, they can say, well, you got hurt on your own time, and to absolve ourselves of responsibility of fixing you, we can just cut you or release you. So if you get hurt training really hard, be in the best shape of your life for spring training, you could be out of a job. It's a risk-reward scenario. I mean, everything is based on your physical health. So I get hurt, and I'm scared to death that this chance, I just ruined it and essentially ruined my life, because no one's going to take another shot on me if I don't come back at 100%. I've got to be perfect for such a middling talent, and if I don't come back at 100%, my career is over. So this just worry fest sets in on me. The general manager of the Blue Jays calls me to tell me that the team is going to do right by keeping me on the DL. And I thought, great, well, everything's taken care of now. They're at least going to get me better. But that's when I fall into a trap that most major leaguers fall into, that I think most of the baseball world doesn't know about, which is when you go into rehab as a major league baseball player, it's the hardest thing you will ever face, because you have to face your own mortality now in the sport. And so a lot of guys fall into depression, addiction, and drug abuse, and they do not turn for psychological help, even though they need it.
And so what happened to you?
Well, I went into major league rehab, and major league rehab actually is kind of a misnomer, because they send you to minor league camp, because that's where they take care of all their products. But now you've been taken away from the major leagues, been taken away from the team that you're a part of, taken away from the people who know you best if you're a major leaguer for any amount of time. You're stuck in this camp with around 50 or 60 bodies, because they take care of everyone in the organization, which means 7 minor league teams plus the major league teams. You no longer get the adulation that you once got from being healthy and a gladiator of modern sport. You no longer have a crowd caring for you. In fact, they do the exact opposite. They're very upset with you because you're costing the organization money, and you're a bum, and you're weak, and you're not healthy. So the isolation and the change in lifestyle start to perpetuate this kind of midlife crisis symptoms, these post-traumatic stress symptoms of you always being healthy and always knowing yourself that way. But in baseball, you cannot talk about your feelings aloud. You can't tell people I'm feeling depressed or feeling isolated, or maybe I'm having anxiety attacks, or maybe I had some kind of psychological issue before this happened. Because if you do, this all goes on your permanent record as a risk liability factor. We've seen it written in the media before. When a player says, I have depression, it's not written, oh, this, it really sucks for this guy, he has depression. It's written that he's a good pitcher, but there's questions about his psychological makeup. So it damages your earnings potential to outwardly confess that you might have trouble dealing with emotion or stress, because those are two things you're going to face a lot in sports. So men turn to things like painkillers, alcohol, drugs of abuse. And that's what I turned to, because I didn't want people to know I was dealing with any of this stuff, because I was afraid it would damage my career chances more than I already had by getting physically hurt.
Well, you have come through to the other side, and you're still involved with the game, but you desperately wanted to hang on, as just about every professional athlete does. It's been said that when an athlete leaves a career, it's like a man dying. You go through some of the same aspects as far as putting your affairs in order, and this happens at a very young age. So when you had to hang it up, what was it like at that point?
I think for me and all the things that I had went through, when I finally retired, it was one of the best moments of my life. I know it sounds strange, but if you walk into any major league clubhouse right now, around 25% of the guys in there, and this is just from the casual observer's perspective, are dealing with some kind of psychological profile that could be seen as a mental illness or adverse to their psyche. And in baseball, a lot of those things are actually necessary for them to make it to the top. A lot of the guys have ADHD. A lot of the guys have anxiety. A lot of those things cause you to focus or be more energetic than somebody else would be who has a little bit more control over themselves. There's bipolar, there's anxiety, depression, manic depression, and the list goes on. A lot of guys struggle from psychological profiles that are negative. And that's just the 25% mm-hmm. that you could spot.
Right. Well, you as you have so eloquently stated, went through some of the same aspects as far as the psychological challenges of playing in a game that is, it is like athletic chess. It's a tough game, and when your body fails you, you come to grips with all kinds of things. You got to know the legendary Dr. James Andrews of LSU pretty well, didn't you?
I did. I got to know the back of his hand pretty well, too.
Well,
Dr. Jimmy.
Yeah.
Jimmy Andrews, he likes to slap his patients around a little bit. And it's playful slapping, but it was the first time I was ever slapped by a doctor. So
did he do a good job?
Doctor.
Did he do a good job?
Oh, he's the best. Yeah. By far. He's a rock star in the field.
A couple of questions from listeners, Dirk. Did you ever use steroids?
I didn't, but I'll tell you what. This might fly contrary to what a lot of people think, but looking back at it now, I almost wish I would have. And I say that because it seems that if you're a superstar in the game and you use steroids, you take a lot of a backlash for that. But a lot of guys who use steroids get paid huge sums of money. Mm-hmm. And if you were a middle ground player like I was, who never would have been famous anyways, no matter how successful I would have got, I just didn't have the tool set. I might have been able to stay in the game longer and make more money. And if I would have had to serve a 50-game suspension, it would have been a slap on the wrist compared to how much money I would have made. So no one makes it out of this game without taking with them some kind of socially defined definition of who they were as a person based on how they played on field. And most of the time it's a false corollary. We hate people who aren't good at baseball because we feel like they failed us and our expectations. So if you're going to take that with you, you might as well have the money too. And I honestly don't get the moral and ethical outrage of people who use steroids. It's a for-profit enterprise. They serve their suspension. They keep the big bankroll. It keeps them healthy over what is the hardest grind of any professional sports schedule, which is 162 straight games. So I've never used it, but I look back and I almost think I would have just faded away and been forgotten. I might as well have the money for it.
It is interesting that two of the greatest players ever in Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, they quite likely were Hall of Famers before they ever used steroids, but yet they couldn't resist late in their careers when they were in their 30s, late 30s. They couldn't resist the help that pharmaceuticals provided.
Well, that's true, and a lot of people, they blast them as if they were these horrible people that should never be in the Hall of Fame, but the Hall of Fame is full of horrible people. It is. It's full of drug users, wife beaters, cheaters. It's full of them, right? Ty Cobb choked a black grounds crewman and then hit his wife when the wife tried to intervene. He knifed a black bellhop. He's one of the most racist, cantankerous people that the sport has ever seen, and he's celebrated as one of the best baseball players ever and one of the faces of baseball greatness. I mean, this is the kind of double standard we have about athletes and their personal choices as it impacts the game and what the game stands for. So I think that in the next 10 years, we will look back at Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, and we will look at this as just another blip in history that has rolled along. We can't play revisionist historian when we look back at these figures. We have to accept them for what they are, what the game allowed, and what culture allowed at that time. We can't correct it now going forward.
Well, it's a fascinating book, The Fourth, from Dirk Hayhurst, Bigger Than the Game, Restitching a Major League Life. Keith Olbermann says a fun read. The book shows why baseball is so often used as a metaphor for life. Thank you, Dirk. Pleasure talking with you, and I'd like to do so again. You're quite a man.
Well, I'll take that as a major compliment from you, sir. Thank you very much, and anytime.
That's a deal. Take care. Bye-bye. 297-5633, and in our remaining moments, we're joined by Mary Ann Wasil. She is the founder of the Get in Touch Foundation. It's a grassroots nonprofit organization in Connecticut, encouraging girls of all ages to get in touch with their bodies. Good morning, Mary Ann.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks so much for having me this morning.
It's good to talk with you. It's a topic that is a bit sensitive, and it's appropriate that I think a woman of your knowledge is involved. How do girls get in touch with their bodies?
Well, we have a wonderful program. The Get in Touch Foundation, as you said, is we are a nonprofit organization. We're a breast health organization, Jim, and we have a wonderful program called the Get in Touch Girls Program and a Daisy Wheel, which is a tool that has 8 tips on it that teach a girl the importance of and how to do a breast self-exam. I myself am a 10-year breast cancer survivor, and my daughters were turning 12 and 13 at the time of my diagnosis. And so I knew that I was now their family history, and I knew that breast health needed to play an important role in their lives for the rest of their lives. And so I taught them how to do a breast self-exam and told them how important it would be for the rest of their lives to know what their normal, healthy breast tissue felt like, and quickly realized that this information and this knowledge, this education, if you will, really belonged to all of our daughters and not just, I say, not just the ones that call me mom. And so started this nonprofit and developed this program so that we can give our program free to schools all over the world, and we're right in Louisiana and at several schools in and around the Baton Rouge area, and we're actually in all 50 states. We're in 26 countries, and it's a real privilege to be able to provide true, honest to goodness, life-saving information to girls who will become women that that can really benefit from the, having this knowledge early in their lives.
Marianne Wasil is our guest. The Get in Touch Foundation is her organization. It provides education for girls in grades 5 through 12 on the importance of and how to do a breast self-exam for life. As far as finding lumps, which might or might not be malignant, this is probably a much better way to diagnose, you know, to find out if you've got an issue than mammograms. But what are your thoughts about how this is a most significant way to combat breast cancer and other afflictions that young women or older women might have?
Well, Dr. Christy Funk, who is the founder of the Pink Lotus Breast Center in California, she says that we have prevention doesn't exist, but right now, early detection is our best defense against breast cancer. Really and truly, it is. And breast self-exam, it's non-invasive, it's free. You could do it as often as you like. And for me, Jim, I discovered the lump on my breast 10 years ago. I had a negative mammogram the next day because I was young and had dense breast tissue. So the mammogram did not pick up this very subtle, discrepancy in my breast tissue. I knew what was normal for me, and when I felt this and knew that this was not right, I got advice from a radiologist to come back in a year that he wasn't worried about it. I pushed, had a biopsy, and had a stage 2 diagnosis. My breast, in fact, was full of cancer, and it had already traveled to my lymph nodes. So knowing your body and being familiar with your body is incredibly important. And our program doesn't teach girls to look for cancer or to look for tumors. It just teaches the girl. There's no mention of cancer in our program. We just want girls to get in touch with their bodies. Just begin to know what is normal and healthy for you. That's important for all of us in every aspect of our lives, really.
Well, we've talked about prostate cancer on this show, which afflicts as many men as breast cancer does women, but usually it's a little later in life. But breast cancer, it is such that women can get it at any time in life.
They really can. And we have several doctors on our consulting board, pediatricians and radiologists and oncologists and breast surgeons. Several of them have diagnosed girls as young as 13 and 14, and while we don't share that information with the girls, and we don't suggest sharing that, really, our intention is to empower, not to frighten anyone. But yes, girls, if you have breast tissue at any age, you're susceptible to breast cancer, and that goes for men as well, Jim. Really, men have breast tissue, and men are diagnosed at a later stage and have a higher mortality rate because most men do not even realize
it's not even on our radar.
Yes, Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Well, it's the GetInTouchFoundation.org, one word, GetInTouchFoundation.org, and you can find out much more about what Marianne Wasil does with her organization and about the involvement of schools in this area. That's the GetInTouchFoundation.org. Thank you very much, Marianne.
Thanks so very much, Jim. I appreciate
it. Nice to talk with you. And if you go to the website, you can find out more about the Foundation's 2014 Pretty in Pink Luncheon and the Women of Strength Awards in Santa Monica. Until tomorrow, happy Mardi Gras, everybody, and we'll be back on Wednesday. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.